I suspect some of you are wondering why I'm here at a conference on Indian law, and actually, I have a long-standing interest. I was born in Arizona next to an Indian reservation. My brother was the liaison with Arizona tribes during his work for the Tucson Police Department for some years. I've written on Indian issues for quite some time, everything from casino gambling controversies to Bruce Babbitt and the Chippewa Indians controversy of the 1990s, and recently the Akaka Bill in Hawaii. And I'm here to introduce our luncheon speaker, Ken Starr. And it represented a bit of a challenge when I came to put down my notes as to how to introduce Ken, because what kind of introduction to give someone who has covered almost every one of the major legal bases with distinction and honor? Ken started out his career as a clerk for Chief Justice Warren Burger, a very auspicious beginning. He then was appointed counselor in his early 30s to U.S. Attorney General William French Smith in the Reagan administration. At the age of 36, he became a federal judge by President Reagan's appointment to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, a signal honor for someone who was only 36 years old. In 1989, he became Solicitor General under President George H.W. Bush. He developed such a reputation for probity and honesty that when the Senate Ethics Committee needed someone to review Republican Senator Bob Packwood's diaries, the committee chose Ken Starr, who was then in private practice, and was praised. His work was praised by Republicans and Democrats alike for its fairness and decency. And that may be one reason why a three-judge federal panel made up of both Republican and Democratic appointees in 1994 decided to name Ken Starr the independent counsel in the ongoing Whitewater investigation. Now, history will always take the Clinton years and make them an issue of great contention. I would submit to you that regardless of the issues that were embroiled in the impeachment controversy, at the heart of the Whitewater investigation was the rule of law. And whether Ken Starr was investigating the potential political abuse of confidential FBI files, travel office firings, Madison Guarantee, the Rose Law Firm, Whitewater, or the possible perjury and obstruction of justice of President Clinton, it was about the rule of law, and it was not about politics. In fact, I'll go so far as to say that despite all of the criticism that Ken Starr received, I can tell you that history is beginning to provide even more vindication for his efforts. First of all, there are those who will continue to say that Whitewater was about nothing. Well, if the Whitewater investigation was about nothing, I don't know why a sitting governor of Arkansas was convicted and sent to prison. I don't know why the number two official in the Justice Department, Webster Hubble, was convicted and sent to prison. I don't know why there were 18 other convictions or guilty pleas in that investigation. It was not about nothing. Just ask the 20 people who pled guilty or were convicted. Secondly, Ken Starr's successor as independent counsel secured an agreement from the sitting president of the United States that he had committed perjury and would pay a large fine and would lose his law license for 5 years. Last time I checked, that was not about nothing. And lastly, we have recent history. We are now entering an era of new politics. And last year, there was a debate within the Democratic Party as to whether or not the era of old politics as represented by the Clintons would be continued or whether there would be a fresh start, a blank slate, a fresh slate, shall we say. And part of that debate was held privately, or perhaps in obscure books you have not read. But I can assure you that much of that debate was whether or not the Clintons should be returned to the center of power in Washington. And a lot of people who had worked with the Clintons decided that they should not support that effort. If you don't believe that the Clintons left an indelible mark both on people who were their political adversaries but people who were their political friends, ask Mark Fabiani, who was the chief Clinton apologist and spokesman during the early days of Ken Starr's independent counsel investigation. And as he told biographer Carl Bernstein, he resigned quietly when he concluded that the actions that he was asked to defend he could no longer believe were necessarily legal. And he felt that there was a pall cast upon the White House that he could simply not defend or justify. Or ask Joel Klein, who was a high-ranking official in the Clinton Justice Department, who has said to many people that the Clintons will stop at nothing to destroy those who oppose them. Ask Eric Holder, who, despite his own mistakes, and who was about to become our Attorney General, and despite his own mistakes in the Mark Rich pardon, believed that he was used and misled in the actions that led up to that pardon. And that was one of the reasons why he chose not to support Hillary Clinton for president. Or ask Greg Craig, who was President Clinton's lawyer during the impeachment controversy, who has told friends and associates and many others in Washington that he decided to endorse Barack Obama because he, of all of the things he had learned about the character of his client during the impeachment controversy. And I could go on and name even more names. All I will say is, Ken, vindication has not only arrived, it is continuing to pile up in your direction. After Ken left as independent counsel, he returned to Kirkland & Ellis in private practice and fought many good legal battles, including, I think, one battle which will stand out in history. He was the lead counsel defending the school choice program in Cleveland, Ohio, where he won a signal victory on behalf of school choice in 2003 before a very divided Supreme Court. And I can assure you, I think the critical and central element, and I say this having spoken to law clerks for Justice O'Connor, one of the critical elements were the briefs that Ken Starr either prepared or supported in that case, which I think will go down in history as one of the most important advances for freedom regarding American education. In 2004, Ken accepted an appointment at Pepperdine Law School as the dean. Pepperdine, which is not far away from here, is one of the truly up-and-coming law schools in this country. 630 students, 40 faculty members, and its Strauss Center for Dispute Resolution ranks first in the nation in the U.S. News rankings of all dispute resolution programs, and that's among 80 programs. And if you want to know who the competition is, number two is Harvard. So given all of that, Ken Starr has mastered all that he has attempted to take hold of. Ken Starr has a fine and outstanding legal career, and now he has expanded his brief to even include some comments to us on Indian and tribal law. And with that, what kind of introduction do you give a man who has accomplished so much? Well, you give him the podium, Ken Starr.
Thank you. Well, thank you for that warm word of welcome and applause. But before he walks out, would you tell John Fund how much we appreciate all of his work, which is just extraordinary. Well, there's so many friends here, I will dispense with my jokes, and my friends will know why, especially my friends from San Diego. How is the bus ride up here today, guys? Oh, good. We got a great San Diego county. You said, I thought you lived over in Malibu. Well, I do, but I had the privilege and great, great pleasure of being with our brothers and sisters in San Diego County and then learned that they were taking a bus up here. So they seem semi-sober, so I'm delighted. Who knows about that bus ride back? Do you have your songs all picked out? That's a long way back to San Diego. It's very appropriate to gather here, and it's always an honor to be in the company of Ronald Reagan's great memory. And so many of us, judges, we remember Ronald Reagan up close and personal, whether we were here in this state. Chuck, do you remember Ronald Reagan up close and personal, even in Sacramento? A very brief tribute to Ronald Reagan. In 1980, the Washington Post ran an op-ed piece, and Chuck, you will appreciate this, and probably others in the room. It was written by, and again, op-ed, by a chap whom I don't know, but he has a great name, Hail Champion. And I think that wasn't even his nom de plume or stage name. I think that was not his nom de guerre. I think that is his, or if he's still here, right? Oh, he's deceased. So Hail Champion writes this piece, and the headline was, Tom, do you remember this? Don't underestimate Ronald Reagan. This is like 2 weeks before the election, John. Well, the polls were showing that the election is really close, really close. Now, for those of you who are from the student chapters, the incumbent president, Jimmy Carter, had not had a particularly, and no one said, oh, this is the greatest presidency since George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. But still, there's especially a cultural sense of disapprobation of this, and you can fill in the blanks, the description, Jeremy, of Ronald Reagan, right? It was not very flattering in the East Coast press. But Hail Champion said, don't underestimate Ronald Reagan. He told the story, which I will very quickly recount, because you would relate to this. I'm identifying everybody over the age of 25, John, who might have been reading the newspapers in that time. And those are the days that we actually read newspapers other than John, the Wall Street Journal. Hale Champion said, "I was a close political advisor to Edmund G. Brown, Jr., Pat Brown. And we tried as best we could in the other party to engineer, to the extent we could, the Republican nomination process so that this unknown, you can fill in the blank, you know, actor would get the nomination. Because we'd be able easily to defeat him as opposed to these more formidable sort of Sacramento denizens who are very experienced in government and so forth." So he told the story of how then Governor-elect Ronald Reagan, as it were, just cleaned the proverbial clock of the incumbent Pat Brown. Don't underestimate Ronald Reagan. Well, the election came in November of 1980, and it was indeed an historic election. The tide had shifted. It was just astonishing and remarkable politically that in a relatively short time, if the polls were to be believed, the polls shifted dramatically in Governor Reagan's favor. And the Washington Post had the decency to run it again. That same Hale Champion, with this sense of disbelief, Bob Bork, Gene, you know, tells the story at the Yale Law School, and you hear different versions of that. People were walking around in a state of utter befuddlement. How could he have won? I don't know anybody who voted for him. You've ever heard that before? Well, they were saying that in New Haven, or at least they were saying that on the campus of a great university, of Yale University. That same piece ran, but here it was, "We told you so." Well, Ronald Reagan had a great gift, and I sat at the lunch table in response to questions, you know, the wilderness years, are we in the wilderness years? Ah, but people march out of the wilderness years very quickly. Pendula change. So, I think the enduring philosophy of liberty, responsibility that Ronald Reagan so beautifully articulated, and which is also a underlying theme of why you gather here, not only lives, it is enduring, it is powerful, and that spirit will return. But it is appropriate to gather here, not only in the spirit of Ronald Reagan, the greatness of his service to the country, but also in this particular location in Southern California. You've already heard from the comments in the first panel that, you know, here are all these tribes, and so many are in California and so forth. But just to the south of us is Los Angeles County. You may know, most of you are from this neck of the woods. We are now in southern Ventura County, but just across the way, across one mountain, is Los Angeles County, the home to 146,000 American Indians. More American Indians in Los Angeles County than any other county in the country. Yeah, and California. Oklahoma, Indian Territory, does not come close, Judge Bea. 689,000 American Indians in California. I'd say, well, Oklahoma, Arizona, probably a very close, John Fons from Arizona, probably a very close second. No. Oklahoma, 390,000. So this is a very appropriate place. And you're also in the land, and you heard that today, of the Chumash. I've learned a fair amount about the Chumash people since coming here. Their history, and there continues to be an unfolding history, of some 10,000 years in these mountains. And I heard from a Chumash that it's very important for us to live always, our people, in these mountains. Not talking about sovereignty, but just carrying on. Because you see, the spirits upon death pass through the westward passage, which is these mountains. And they find their way through these mountains to the spirit world. That's been a belief for 10,000 years. So here we are. And in fact, this very city, Simi Valley, is a Chumashian name. and so is the place where I'm privileged now to live and to work, Malibu. It's a Chumash name. And so when we talk about sovereignty, let me turn to what the Chumash say. Specifically, the Santa Ynez Band of the Chumash Indians say this on their website on page 1. Sovereignty is the lifeblood of Native Americans. To Native Americans, sovereignty is not possession of the land, nor power or control over it. Simply put, sovereignty is the living relationship between the people and the land they live on. And when you hear American Indians speak, it's become part of the broader culture of the seventh generation, the sense of timelessness of culture. You understand how deeply felt these sentiments are. It's also very timely and topical. You're going to be talking this afternoon about the Akaka Bill, but also how many beneficiaries direct of the bailout do we have here in the room? Any TARP beneficiaries? John, how about the motion picture industry? Any?
Not yet.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you should go into the car building business or start an investment banking fund. But Judge O'Scanlan, it's very timely, not just because of what is happening in the Article I branch on the Akaka Bill and the future of Hawaii, and the Ninth Circuit may very well be seeing some of these issues in the fullness of time, depending on what happens. But I give you a report from Indian Country Today and their website, and the story originally published on January 16, 2009, was just updated on January 23rd, so not so long ago. Tell Jody I used all this. Jeremy will understand. Senator Tim Johnson, Democrat of South Dakota, and several of his colleagues sent a letter to President Barack Obama just before inauguration, asking him to support a $3.5 billion plan to fund a range of Indian Country programs as part of an economic stimulus proposal. In the brief time that I wanted to share a thought or two with you, I wanted to really look at Indian law and use an example from our current Supreme Court and to see if we can learn perhaps a little bit of Indian law, but perhaps more permanently, a little bit more about the Supreme Court of the United States and the way it thinks about substantive Indian law under the leadership of our very distinguished anti-split infinitive Chief Justice, John Glover Roberts, Jr., a great man who has adorned this podium and to great, great applause. But I cannot, given my profound interest in constitutional issues generally and First Amendment issues and religion clauses issues more specifically, fail to just by way of reminder, because there's no other reason that it would come up today, because in a way it's not directly on point in terms of sovereignty, but remember Employment Division versus Smith with members of the Native American Church seeking to use peyote as part, and everyone agreed, this is sincere. This is part of the traditions. And when we talk about traditions, friends, we're not talking about 200 years. Right? So let's just honor to whom honor is due. We're talking about thousands of years of culture. And speaking through Justice Scalia, famously, Oregon Division, Department of Employment versus Smith, looking at the practices of these two individuals who were terminated from their jobs in a drug rehabilitation center in Oregon because they had ingested peyote, what? Sacerdotally. There was no diversion. It was right in the mainstream of the Native American church's practices and a revolution in First Amendment free exercise thinking was effected in the substance of materials that you had before this gathering, of the need to re-examine the premises. And so let me, instead of characterizing, let me just call Justice Thomas to the podium, and here are his words. United States versus Lara. As this case should make clear, the time has come to re-examine the premises and logic of our tribal sovereignty cases. It seems to me, Justice Thomas says, that much of the confusion reflected in our precedent arises from two largely incompatible and doubtful assumptions. So listen to the assumptions. First, rather than some other part of the federal government and our separation of powers system, Congress can regulate virtually every aspect of the tribes without rendering tribal sovereignty a nullity. This plenary power that Congress enjoys under the Constitution as interpreted by the Supreme Court of the United States over time. Second, this is the juxtaposition, the Indian tribes retain inherent sovereignty to enforce their criminal laws against their own members. That's one dimension of, obviously, tribal sovereignty. It's very multidimensional. These assumptions, which I must accept as the case comes to us, dictate the outcome in this case, and I therefore concur in the judgment, but I write separately because the court fails, and this is so characteristic of Justice Thomas, to sort of blow the whistle. We need to kind of deconstruct and return to first principles, he would say, and to examine these tensions of a result that flows from the court's inadequate constitutional analysis. Almost no one seems to be terribly happy with the state of Indian law. Perhaps I'm mistaken, and Judge Bea and Judge O'Scanlan can readily correct me, that everybody is happy, but I don't think that's true. I think there's a sense of, if not incoherence, at least things have not been particularly well worked out. And is there something in the 5 minutes that remain before questions and answers that I can offer by way of the current court, under our very able Chief Justice, in thinking through some of these issues? Well, I will just say, I look to the hills whence my help comes. I don't think looking to Capitol Hill, but particularly the Supreme Court, is particularly a reason to be sanguine. It's going to have to be worked out here in this conference. And I submit to you, by way of example, the decision, and I shared this with Judge O'Scanlan just before lunch, because when I reflected on what the Roberts Court is doing in the area of Indian law, the short answer is not much, but what it does is important. It's had three cases and so forth, and this is not a case report, so try to stay away. What I'm going to do now in 4 minutes is to tell you that the case of Plains Commerce Bank versus Long Family Land and Cattle, if you've heard of the case, please don't raise your hand. You would be a terrible show-off. Who's heard of this case? Well, it was decided when? In the 19th century? No. June 25, 2008. Briefly stated, Plains Commerce Bank in South Dakota is 25 miles away, as Chief Justice Roberts put it in his opinion for the majority, as the crow flies, from the nearest point of the reservation. But it does a lot of business with the reservation. And part of the business it was doing was with the Long Family Land and Cattle Co., Indian owned. Notwithstanding the name, don't let the name fool you. It was Indian. Everybody agree. You bet. Lots of read Justice Ginsburg's dissent, and you'll see how Indian it is. It's a really Indian company. Well, lots of acres, lots of cattle, and lots of financial problems were characteristic of the Long Family Land and Cattle Company. And finally, the bank says, it's over. And sells the land to non-Indians. The court divided over the issue of tribal sovereignty 5-4. Five justices, can you name them? Yes, you can. Yes, I can. Yeah, I've heard that. Yes, you can name them. Five justices said no tribal court sovereignty. And if you want, if this is an area, you said, Indian law, until I got on the bus from San Diego, I'd never even heard of Indian law, never took a course in it, don't have much of a practice in it. Some people here do, right, Ralph? I mean, this is important and practical in the West and parts of the East as well. Even if you haven't thought about Indian law, read this because you will then see something which I was aware of and have talked to tribal court judges, as you know. The tribes have their own adjudicatory system. Over who? Members of the tribe, right? Gets very delicate if you're dealing with non members of the tribe. Right, Tom? General, non-members of the tribe. Wait a second. Who are you asserting jurisdiction over? But you see, the two owners of Long Family were Indians. They were enrolled in the Cheyenne River Sioux tribe. That's very, very solid. And they said, we think the bank has treated us shabbily. They have foreclosed. And then they entered into a sweetheart deal with non-Indians. We have been, lots of charges, but we have been victimized by anti-Indian discrimination. And so the tribal court, jury trial, Tom, I didn't realize this, seven-member jury. Here's all the evidence, you know, special interrogatories. I mean, this is a very well-developed system, adjudicatory system, in a number of the Indian tribes, finds in favor of the Indians. Over the bank's objection, saying, wait a second, two key facts here. The land we're talking about, yes, is on the reservation, which once was 60 million, but after Congress in the 1887 Allotment Act changed all that, it's now down to 11 million acres. But you see, part of the Allotment Act was land can be owned in fee, and we, the bankers, owned the land. It's not owned by tribal members. So there was the issue. In a very, very well-reasoned opinion, Chief Justice Roberts says, you know, we're looking at all the laws and all of our precedents, including United States versus Montana and the different exceptions, and what we see is, Bernie Siegan would be very proud, when it comes to the sale of the land as opposed to the conduct of persons on the land, the tribal courts do not have sovereignty. Because it's non-member fee on land. That's the basic point of the opinion. The dissent, in contrast, said, I understand all that, but don't you understand how important anti-discrimination laws are? And don't you see that if you read Montana, so reasonable minds can take the same case and read it differently, that exception one of United States versus Montana fits this like a glove. Read footnote one of the Chief Justice Roberts' response. Have I piqued your... No, I haven't piqued your interest. Shame on you if I have not done so. How important the word not is. I close with this. Justice Ginsburg questions the distinctions between sales of land and activities on the land, saying that, quote, sales of land, he is quoting from Justice Ginsburg's dissent, and related conduct are surely activities, that's a magic word, under United States versus Montana, within the ordinary sense of the word. In other words, if you sell the land, that's an activity on the land. Chief Justice Roberts, we think the distinction is readily understandable. There you have it, an example of a current issue in Indian law and the great divide that divides the nine members of our Supreme Court. Thank you very much. We have just a couple of minutes for questions, or do we not? I'm looking to Jean for guidance. Judge, safe travels. Oh, no, sorry. Never note when the judge is rising from the bench. Yes, please. Good to see you, Carl.
You referred to tribal law. Now, if a tribal one United States is claiming a legal similarity of the law, among the various states. We all know it's Anglo-Saxon derived except for Louisiana. But what about tribal law? Where does this antecedent come from? And is there a commonality among all the tribes? What are the differences?
I would defer on that. Where does Indian law come from, and are there similarities, you know, common law, et cetera? And the short answer is we need someone who knows something about that subject to answer that question. Do I see any hands? But the short, okay, she'll answer it later. But interestingly enough, the concept of fair dealing, fair play, which was being applied by this particular tribal court, was seen as, I'm not sure there was sort of a universal, shall I say, natural law, but a sense of fair dealing, because it was not a specific anti-discrimination statute that was being embraced by, as I understand it, by the tribal court, but rather that large principle of law that we would say is in equity, of fair dealing, fair play, and so forth, and that the bank had violated that precept of fair dealing, fair play. Could someone ask me a question about other than substantive Indian law? But no, that was great, great. It was unfortunately, it was a perfectly appropriate question. It just goes to show, although in California, assumption of the risk is a totally dead doctrine, it could be invoked against me right now. Any other questions before we close? Gene, I thought that was the sign for me to leave. He said, if I raise my hand, you know. But with respect to Indian law, are you talking about?
With respect to him taking, you know, what's important to some of these tribes might not be important to a lot of other Americans. The sense of our ancestors in that particular way is not that common in other parts of society. But it's a very real thing.
Boy, that's a huge question, and again, I feel totally inadequate. You know, usually you prepare for oral argument and so forth. You know, Gene is so smart, so while I filibuster to try to figure out a nice response, but taking into account the spirit, if I apprehend, and I probably don't, the thrust of your elegant question, it seems to me that what has happened is Congress has said, and I'll be corrected at the podium, Congress has said, we're no longer going to do any more of these treaty things, but we are just going to be, we just rule. What we say goes. And what they say goes is, we want you to enjoy what the court has called limited sovereignty. And so it seems to me there is a sort of crude balance that we want sort of autonomous regions, as it were, roughly autonomous regions, which has become bewilderingly complex because of all of the non-member activities and non-member land ownership in what was once a much more coherent and cohesive reservation with non-member persons, with non-member lands, and so forth. And so it becomes this very difficult mosaic. And it seems to me that, and on top of this, is the Supreme Court has superintended the Smith principle, which is if it is a general law, neutral, of general applicability, then it's going to be very hard for us to agree unless there's powerful, you know, positive law that points us in that direction of actually creating a pro-Indian exception. The Smith principle of equality and neutrality strikes me as being very, very strong in U.S. jurisprudence, which, of course, tends to say, you know, even though you wanted to impose those taxes, the Indian taxes, and to be free from the state taxes at that Indian-owned gas station, no dice. You're just not free from these laws of general applicability. So I think the Smith principle has sort of trumped the idea of these autonomous, at most I think we could say semi-autonomous, sovereigns that can, in fact, govern an ever more limited nature of their activity. Thank you very much. God bless you. I'm sorry, our time has expired. I'll come answer the question. John, thank you for the introduction.